It's Wednesday, September 8th, 2010, and you're listening to episode 203 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 57 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name's Chad.
This is Wayne.
And my name is Pat.
Quick reminder to everyone that September 15th is fast approaching, which is the deadline to get a discount on Tracy Hickman's current book effort, the Dragon's Bard series, starting off with the first book, Eventide, which actually three of us have already picked up. And if you're interested in getting in on this as well, there is a discount that he's extended to Fear the Boot listeners, and all you have to do is enter a code in on the site before September 15th to get that discount. And I will put a link to that in the show notes. And with that code, you will get an autographed and numbered copy of the book, the audio fiction, PDFs as he's writing it, access to the forums, and all kinds of other stuff. And also, a couple people were commenting that they're interested in it, but they don't know that they want to drop what, with our discount, is $47 on this whole package. There is also pricing that he's put out there if you want to get only the audiobooks or do a stuff like on a...
I'd drop $47 on Tracy's package.
Or I already did.
Yeah, I did too.
Or if you just want to get it as a pay-by-chapter sort of thing, or pay-as-you-go thing. He does have some other pricing models that are available now. And once again, I'll try to pull this in the show notes.
Yeah, and to be honest, I haven't actually read a page of it. I've been listening to the audio portion and absolutely loving it. You know, I'm going to read the entire thing once I get the physical copy, but just listening to the audio has been great for me.
The one thing I would mention is, as far as the discount goes, just to make sure that people are actually smarter than I am, it took me a minute or two to figure out how to apply the discount, because I typed in the code and then went to like hit order or something. There's actually a box that says apply discount code, and then you have to click that, and that actually applies the code before you go to checkout. So I was just entering it and then going straight to checkout, and I'm like, why isn't this discounting? Just an FYI.
I think our listeners are smart enough to figure that out.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, I have to say that that interview really surprised me, because going into it, I was the sort of guy that Battletech was my game more so than D&D growing up, unlike a lot of role players. I had played in some Dragonlance games, but I'd never read any of his fiction. So I thought, surely going into this, this is going to be a guy who just wrote this fantasy stuff back from the 80s and 90s, and he's going to be some old grognard or whatever. And that interview really surprised me.
I was D&D nerd who talks about nothing but dragons. That's kind of what I was expecting, and I was very wrong. He's a very intelligent guy.
It just goes to show you that, yeah, you know, preconceived notions of people, yes, are oftentimes they're baseless.
Right.
And I feel the same way. I have read his stuff and I enjoyed it as when I was, you know, younger and everything like that, but I had never looked into anything about him. I just never had any reason to, so I had absolutely no idea, you know, what it was going to be like that beforehand either. So yeah, it was a great experience, just because, you know, I got to learn about somebody, you know, learn their feelings are, what their thoughts on role playing in general. And it was just, I don't know if it was surprising as much as it was just learning something new. It's just like having a conversation with anybody that you meet, like a new friend or whatever, you learn about them. And that's just something that I had never done before.
I think I just expected him to be diametrically opposed to everything this show represents.
And when it turned out, he's Chad in disguise.
Yeah, instead he's actually, he's the far opposite extreme.
He's an intelligent and handsome man.
So he's definitely like Chad.
I'll take that.
You know, I had no preconceived notions, because in my case, fantasy is not my genre. This was the first story that I've
listened to. I know, it's vampire romance fantasy.
That's still not my genre.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the first fantasy story that I've had a part in that isn't a Tolkien story. I haven't read a fantasy novel ever. I haven't listened to one because it's just not my genre. I'd never even heard the word orc before the first Lord of the Rings movie.
I've already decided the next book you need to read to further your fantasy love and desire, you need to read The Silmarillion. I really think that will go a long way.
I have.
You have? Oh, okay. Well, never mind.
Like I said, it's the first non-Tolkien I've read.
Damn, I'm surprised. I love that book, but most people hate it because it's kind of dry.
It's an encyclopedia.
And it's an encyclopedia history book. I thought it was great. It's fantastic.
I want to give a quick shout out to our WoW guild.
Fear the Guild.
Yeah, and I say our guild, but actually, it's our in the sense that it is...
It's the community's
it's
guild.
It's the community guild.
We didn't start this.
It's Fear the Boot.
We're guild. Not even the officers. None of the hosts are the guild masters.
Yeah, exactly. We do not
they
run this
guild.
They
barely let me into the guild.
That was
I'm in under protest.
And you have a parole officer.
That's true.
Wait, that's real life.
Oh, whoops.
I had to tell him you were a real life friend. I couldn't tell him who you actually were.
But yeah, it's a bunch of people on the forum that are running it. Most of us, actually all of us on the mics right now, it's all the hosts pretty much sans
they
Chris,
suckered me in, man.
Are playing in the guild and having a lot of fun. So if you're looking to pick up World of Warcraft as Cataclysm comes out, or you're currently in there, be sure to hop on over. It's the guild assembly called Fear the Guild, and it's on the Alliance side of the Argent Dawn server. They've got a forum area going, which I'll link to in the show notes, but we'd love to see you over there. There's already quite a few of us playing. Yep. And so if you're already playing the game anyway, hell, might as well join us.
I love being on Argent Dawn because I've never been on an RP server before. I don't RP. Nobody in the guild RPs, but there's RP going on and it's either emo or sex or emo sex. That's the only kind of RP that happens.
I'm missing all this. I haven't seen any of that.
I was asking somebody about that because I've said several times that one of the cool things about doing this show is the fact that it has broadened my views. Mm-hmm. When I came into the show, I had a lot of prejudices and preconceived notions.
No, I'm dead right about role-playing on WoW.
Well, and some of them have been confirmed. Some of them have been nuanced. Others have been dispelled. And it was really eye-opening, for example, a while back to actually start talking to some LARPers and realize that they hate the Dark Lord of Denny's as much as we do. That yeah. I was judging the hobby based on a segment of people that even the mainstream
the negative
hobby,
stereotype in their minds.
Precisely. Yeah. And I was talking to somebody about role-playing in an MMO. Because to me, I just don't see how you can possibly have role-playing in an MMO unless it's emo sex.
Or emo sex. Yeah.
Because I mean, how do you explain the fact that basically you need people of a certain level and certain party balance to go out and farm the same boss monster 100 times over, and yet for some reason she keeps coming back?
Yeah, there's a lot of suspension of disbelief.
I had no problem doing it in City of Heroes. I just never did the same mission twice.
Somebody sat down and briefly explained it to me, and I would be curious at some point, maybe down the road, I don't know if this would be a full show, maybe as a banter topic or something, to get somebody on here to really talk about it, because what they were saying is that you can role play, but you have to write a story that almost has nothing to do with the gameplay. That what you do is you get a whole bunch of RP props and clothing, and you take like the Halloween costumes that let you appear as members of other races, like the other faction and such, and you set up the story with all this politics and intrigue and play out
a game within a game.
Yeah, you play out sort of your own like medieval court drama. Mm-hmm. That has nothing to do with the main gameplay. And it's one of those things, I don't know if I'd want to do it, but it sounded a whole lot less stupid than what I had seen so far. And I'd be curious to really hear somebody explain in detail how they make that work.
And yeah, I make fun of them, but I got on a boat and I went into the hold to find the vendor because I don't RP. I'm not looking for that. But there are these guys and they were sitting at the table because you can mechanically sit down on the chairs, and they were RPing and talking about their voyage and stuff. And it was pretty interesting. And then they got off, and when they got off the boat, they were walking and they were walking down the dock. And as they were walking down the dock, they were talking about adventuring and they were role playing adventurers, so that it's natural for them to just walk off the dock and then go start killing things, because that's what they do in character. And it, you know, it was pretty interesting. Not quite my thing, but you know what I do is I do courtesies. I don't disrupt the role play. And then when I see role players or something walking down the, like this, these guys are walking down the dock. I was running up the dock on my mount. I got out of their way so I didn't clip through them.
Right.
Because to me, if I were doing that, that would take away from my experience and my immersion. So
and that's
I didn't want to do that to
pretty
them.
Much where I'm at is mm-hmm. I don't know this is something I'm looking to dive into.
I just don't think WoW is a very good game for RP.
Truth be told, I don't think much of any MMO is. Yeah. But I would just be curious to hear somebody explain how it works and to really expose me to this side of the role-playing hobby.
I would love to do it. I mean, I just don't see how it would work in something like WoW. Like in City of Heroes, I did a lot of this because I was playing by myself. So either just myself or my wife. So there was no repeating the same thing over again. And she actually would get annoyed with me because if I was traveling even the low levels, it would take me forever to get where she was. Unless I was flying so far above that I couldn't see it, I couldn't help but stop every single mugging, even though they're crazy to drop nothing, because I am a superhero and I can't walk past this mugging.
Wow.
There are a lot of muggings in that game.
Yes, there are.
It's a very dangerous
game. That's actually why I used to take flying, one of the reasons, because I could fly up, set where I'm going, go grab a drink, so I didn't have to see what was happening on the screen.
That's immersion,
because even
man.
If I'm flying and I look down and I see the green glow of the Circle of Thorns, well, they're taking someone's soul. I can't fly past that.
Wayne's Awkward Confessions.
Okay, so...
This is why I don't do role-playing in something like WoW. Well, besides the fact that I can't seem to get into my character because my appearance keeps changing.
I think the ultimate point, all the role-play and silly stories aside, I think the ultimate point is that Cataclysm, now I'm going to sound like a shill for Blizzard, but they don't need me to be a shill. Cataclysm is coming out. When it comes out, it's changing the game. This is basically World of Warcraft 2 from everything we're reading. And that's kind of why we are all coming back to it, because I left and I never intended to come back. All the stuff in Cata sounded cool. All my friends were playing World of Warcraft. A Fear the Boot guild started up that we had nothing to do with because all of our World of Warcraft guilds fail. And any new MMO that comes out that we make a guild in, that MMO fails. So we are really, really hands-off in this one. And I just think it would be really cool if you're thinking about getting back into World of Warcraft to kind of experience this new beginning level content and to kind of play the game again. We're a friends and family guild. We're a casual guild. We're here to help each other. We're here to have fun. It's just a cool bunch of people. We have events. Now I sound like a guild shill. You know, it's like, we have Vincer, we have a tavern, we have bank slots.
Well, you know what, I don't want to beat this to death, but I think really that is kind of the punchline. We're not selling the game.
Yeah.
We're selling the guild. Let's talk about homebrews. There's an observation I've made about the people behind the mics, maybe not all of us, but certainly most of us, which is that we seem to love our homebrews. And obviously, we are far from alone. There are lots and lots of people out there that are making their own games with varying levels of ambition.
You can't get much more indie than a homebrew.
No. And in some cases, these people want to get the stuff published and have the misconception they're going to make fat bank. In other cases...
you're serious.
In other cases, folks are just making them to play themselves, just to have fun with at home. And I want to kind of explore this whole thing of the homebrew more from the psychological side. I don't want to try and resurrect the design series. We may do that someday further down the road. But even now, I am brave enough to reattempt the video episode. I am still not brave enough to reattempt the design series.
You know, a whole bunch. When you said we're going to maybe try design series again a little down the road, I think half of our listeners just cheered, started honking the horns, flipping the lights in their car. And the other half
just,
are like,
just hit forward on the iPod.
Yeah, they're just like, unsubscribe.
So let's start the discussion with just a very simple Rorschach test sort of question. Why do we make these homebrews?
I think that the knee-jerk, snap, snark answer is, well, there's nothing in the industry that's coming out that's any good. And you know what? That's a bunch of BS. There's a lot of good products out there by a lot of very talented people.
They may be hard to find because of the number of them. But yeah, you can't throw that much stuff at the wall and not have something stick.
Yeah, exactly. For me, though, I want different combinations of things. I like this mechanic from this game. I like this mechanic from this game. I like this piece of a story from this world. I like these characters from this world. I like this concept from this TV show. I like this other concept that somebody I know was talking about. I like this other idea that I had come up with. I want to combine them in a coherent way, not in a riffs way, although that sounds like I'm insulting riffs. I kind of am, but I mean, I mean that in a riffs is an amalgam. It's this Frankenstein monster of all these different concepts. I mean to bring all these different concepts into something more coherent that flows together, not just a buffet of ideas. And to get exactly what I want, I basically have to homebrew that when it comes to mechanics and story and all that stuff. And the other fact, just the barest, plain, simple fact. I enjoy making my own game.
That, for me, is right where I would start. It's that creative drive.
Mm-hmm.
I remember going all the way back into my childhood that when I was sitting there playing with toys, my brother and I, Tex, we had model ships. He was into building model ships. Not like tall ships, but like battleships and aircraft carriers. I remember one of mine was I had a model of the German battleship, the Tirpitz and such. We also, of course, had G.I. Joe and Transformers and stuff. But when we played with them, we didn't just kind of fly around the room making silly noises and going pew, pew, pew. We actually had interconnecting dramas and characters. And it was little kids stuff. But for little kids stuff, there was a lot of complexity and continuity to all of it. I mean, I have had this drive to create as long as I can remember. And when I found this thing of role-playing games, I remember before I actually owned my first role-playing game, before I had that fastest Star Trek RPG in 1988, I knew what the concept was. I kind of understood what it was about. And so I sat down with notebook paper and was creating my own from scratch. So I suppose in many ways, the first RPG I ever played was not that fastest Star Trek game I commonly refer to, but actually was Homebrews of Tron and Robotech that I wrote and was playing with my sisters. Mm-hmm. And I think that carries over for me into adult life. I develop a setting in my head, sitting there bored in class or at work or in the car, and these stories and settings start coming to mind. And I want to bring them to life. And I could take an existing system, but as someone who's got somewhat of a mathematical mind, I mean, I'm not super engineer guy, but I've got somewhat of a mathematical mind. And I'm a firm believer that system implies setting and therefore ought to work with the setting. So I start kind of reverse engineering that setting into a system of what sort of math would represent the feel that I want. And before I know it, I've got a notebook full of a game or at least enough stuff in my head to run it on the fly.
I think there's a lot of innate creativity in the hobby, just in general. You know, a lot of the people that play are that way, like what you're talking about. I think you start with a system. You sort of cut your teeth on it. Maybe you sort of learn the basics. And I think it's a fairly natural progression for a lot of people to say, you know what? I think I can do things maybe a little bit better, or maybe not, if not better, in a way that makes more sense to me or and maybe my group of friends. So you'll sort of branch off and make those home brews. I know that that's the way I am. I'm always looking at things just in general life, like little projects, things around the house. I do a lot of things, you know, a lot of handiwork, whatever like that, because I've got a pretty good idea how to do it. I'm also an engineer, so it sort of follows from that. But I'm always doing that kind of a thing. And it's so for me, it's sort of natural. I've never made a homebrew myself, but I've played in many of them with my friends and even helped them design them and help them work things out. So I just think it's something that flows naturally in this community.
Well, you have to have some degree of creativity to participate in the hobby, because even as a pure player, you still have to make something.
It may just be
a character.
You know, according to Gary Gygax, in his Master Game Master redonkulous book, he totally agrees with what you said, Pat, is that you first start playing a game, you make a character, and then you make a bunch of characters and you want to make a game. You want to run a game, and then you run several games, and then the next logical creative step is to create your own game. And then from there, the next logical creative step is to try to do something with the game, like sell it.
Yeah.
And then the next logical step after that, of course, is to run a convention to support your game.
I don't know about that, but
he does. And as silly as that book is, I mean, I agree. You make a character, you make a bunch of characters, and you want to run a game and you want to tell a greater story and keep going.
I've never been the sort of person so arrogant to look at role-playing games, especially given the number of games out there and some of the really brilliant people that are involved in them, and say, I can do it better, but I will happily say, I can do it better for me.
Mm-hmm.
That I can do it better for what I or my group or my setting call for.
You can do it different. I mean, that's the other thing, too. It's not necessarily about better or whatever. It's just something new.
Or you could even say
that's how new things are made, you know.
Or you could even say that it's not even better or worse or whatever. It's just like, I like this from game A, but I like this other thing from game B, and I like this other thing from game C.
Yeah.
And you know what? With a little tweaking, I can put them all together and add a little something of my own, and there you go.
One of the interesting things for me is that coming in as a player who doesn't have a lot of system experience, when someone brings a new homebrew to the table, it's new to everyone. Everyone is on level with me. They're having to learn it as well. And I don't feel quite as overwhelmed by, you know, people already know exactly what they want to do because they know what numbers add up to what. And along the same lines, most homebrews I've played are at least a little bit simpler than some of the published systems because they're not as big of a book. There's not so much of it already defined. So from running a homebrew standpoint, I feel more comfortable in it because I know that nobody's going to come with the book. I know that nobody's going to come in already knowing everything about it, even if it's not my own homebrew, because I ran Skies of Glass, a Fear the Con. I knew going in, people know something about the system. No one has ever played this version of the system except for our group. I knew going in, I had at least that advantage. It made me feel comfortable. Now, someone who's played for years and has run more games doesn't need that. I wanted that crutch.
You know what? They still need that crutch. Running a game for a bunch of people, and this is Oh, no, tangent. Running a game for a bunch of people, it's still a confidence game. Game mastering, part of it is imagination. Some of it is preparation, but a lot of it is confidence.
And especially honestly, at a convention.
Especially at a convention. And you know what? I have been to a lot of conventions. I have played in a lot of convention games. I have run conventions. And I had never run a convention game until this Gen Con, because it was a confidence thing. I just didn't think that I would be very good at running a game for strangers. And I kind of popped that cherry, and it went really well, and I really enjoyed it. And I'm going to run games at the next Fear the Con.
When I found that out, too, was such a big ego boost for me that I had run COD games before Chad. Yeah, and as of right now, I have run more COD games than Chad has.
Yeah. I had never thought about it from that angle, Wayne, that part of the advantage of a homebrew is confidence. I guess even if this is your first time GMing, it's not a con game, it's for your regular weekly group, you still walk in with the knowledge that nobody knows more about this game than you do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Nobody can veto you unless you're internally inconsistent. I had never thought about it from that angle, but that's absolutely true. Well, here's a question that Chris raised, but he's too old to be on the show right now. So I'll go ahead and raise it on his behalf. We were kicking this around a little bit in forum discussions amongst ourselves. And what Chris asked is, if you're going to make a homebrew, given the fact that there is probably already a game at least somewhat similar in system to your idea, why is it we go for starting from scratch as opposed to taking an existing game and modifying it? For example, the way that back when this was the big fad, the D20 system was getting modified 10,000 ways to Sunday to make it fit different games and different feels. Mm-hmm.
And in actuality, when Chad was creating his homebrew, that's what he did. He started with an experience he enjoyed, Dread. Mm-hmm. And that was the basis for him to create his own game system off of. Yeah.
And I modified the hell out of Dread.
Yeah. All the homebrews that, well, not all the ones because yours are different, but the ones that I started with were exactly that. They were systems that were modified from basically D&D. You know, you took that as a basis and changed some things there. So you did have that as a starting point. I would even venture so far as to say that a fair number of these homebrews are just a modification.
Now, I have even made homebrews before I even met you guys that are totally, they're not original in that there's nothing new under the sun. We're still talking about stats and dice and different tie types, but they're original in that they're not taken from any particular game. I have done that before to suit my needs. And what that was, it was a collaborative thing. I kind of worked with it with my group to make the mechanics of it, but that's something that I'm really into right now. I'm really into this concept of collaboration in games, collaborative creation of characters, where you work with the other people and you work with the game master. That's always kind of a given. Collaborative storytelling, everybody is working together to tell the story. A collaborative world building, where everybody is taking sections of the world and relating them to everyone else's section of the world, and then everyone is playing their characters in that world. And I think that the next step beyond that is collaborative rules building to get the mechanics that people want and to combine them into something that everybody is really happy with. I would love to run or take part in a game where there is that collaboration on every single level, where we start the game totally blank slate. What do you guys want to play?
Well, and hold that thought, because that's one that I want to actually come back to here in a couple minutes as a topic in its own right. Mm-hmm. But is part of your answer that,
you know, I asked you the question. I don't even remember the question anymore.
Well, but I think you did answer it. Because the question was, why not just modify an existing rule set?
Right.
But if you're looking to collaborate from the ground up, you can't do that with an existing rule set. Yeah.
The closest I think you can come is to say,
because you're accepting an intruder at the table, which is right. The authors of the RPG book.
Yeah. Well, and I think that if you're doing like a collaborative mechanics thing on this layer of collaboration, I think people can say, hey, I really like the Savage Worlds initiative system. Let's use that initiative system. But I don't like anything else about Savage Worlds. And then somebody's like, okay, well, you know what? I really like rolling D20s. So why don't we just do a D20 mechanic for two hits and stuff? Okay, that's cool. We'll do that. Well, what about this other original idea that's not used anywhere else? Like, okay, well, let's stir that into the pot.
When I was looking at Chris's question, I think for me, it looked like a category mistake in that I do modify rule systems. That's what house ruling is.
Yeah. I don't think we've played a straight vanilla system in ever.
Very few. There are very few. I house rule to some degree almost everything I run. I typically don't house rule them too far because there comes a point where there's just too much to keep track of. This was part of what I think was one of the failings of this whole D20 system thing, was they started with this basis of the D20 system, and the idea was supposed to be that now there was one system. So that way, people coming into the hobby or going from one game to the next didn't have to relearn a system. But then people started adapting it to their needs, and in some cases adapted it so heavily, it was effectively a new rule system anyway. And I think with house ruling, you can reach a point where you have departed so far from the original product, you have a completely new product. You might as well just call it a homebrew. But I do house rule everything I run. The Star Trek game, the ship-on-ship combat aspect of it, which I've now run at multiple cons, I have completely revamped the way that shields are handled in that game. They're supposed to originally be threshold shields, where they take up to a certain point value after which they're gone. I changed them to leaky shields, where instead they block out a percentage of damage, because I felt that better captured the feel I wanted out of a Star Trek ship-on-ship combat game. If I'm looking at something like, let's take my homebrew, Apocrypha Rhysos, I'm going for a completely different feel of game. Heavy exchanges between ships that don't have shielding, they have armor plating, and they're losing cabins. It's a much more brutal and gritty sort of combat. This Star Trek game is not going to give me that. And if I try to house rule to the point that it does give me that, once again, I might as well just accept I've created my own game anyway, because the house rule modifications are going to be as thick as the original rule book. And twice as confusing, because now you have two sets of documents to refer to. You have the starting document, and then you have the amendments and vetoes over here.
And then I think there is also a point that someone on our forums made. There was a debate about house rules and should people use house rules. When you use house rules, are you really even playing the original game anymore? And I think that
it's a shade of gray.
I think it's a shade of gray. I mean, it's like, logic. Sure, if you tweak one or two things, yeah, whatever. But I do think that you can house rule something to the point where you say, why are we playing this? Why don't we just write our own system?
At the loss of which hair is a man balding. It's that sort of logic. I mean, obviously, two house rules and it's still the same game. When does it stop being the same game? Three house rules, four house rules, mm-hmm. 10, 100, 1,000. But yeah, I absolutely agree with your point. There is something that came out of years of writing these homebrews that I would love to extend as a challenge to anyone that has never attempted writing a homebrew, which is try it. Take out a spiral bound notebook.
National RPG Writing Month?
No.
We could get thousands of poorly written, crappy stories. And
I think you should host the website
games
for it.
No, no, and no again.
Let me tweet that now. We have to get everyone started now.
Now, yes. October is national, international role-playing game writing month.
And Dan promises to read all of them.
I'm going
to
start.
I don't. Dan does.
I'm going to start a viral YouTube tweet to get this rolling. We are so going to get a million people to want the old Facebook back.
I could see the page now. Like this page to petition Fear the Boot to sponsor National Role-Playing Game Writing Month. We need more 2,000-word role-playing games.
No, if people are going to join one of our peripheral groups, I would recommend instead to join our Facebook page for Midna Shouldn't Be Hot, But She Is.
My greatest creation ever. Because there's pregnant Minda in there, and that's horrible.
But
Pat's like, what in the are you guys talking about?
But we've talked about how a lot of times to really get what a GM goes through, to have sympathy for them, to make yourself a better player, you have to put yourself on the hot seat at least once. You've got to try GMing, even if you hate it, just to understand what goes into the process. In the same way,
should you try role-playing game writing just once?
One of the things that I've thought about
is, I don't know, man.
I should make everyone who's on this podcast edit a show at least once, because it would radically change their damned mic habits. Ice cup.
You know, I think I have fairly decent mic habits. I do my part, and I take this nitrogen over here.
I wonder if in the same way, there is something you get out of the experience of creating a homebrew, of developing your own setting, developing your own map. And I'm not saying this has to be 300 pages, But even if you just take out a spiral-bound notebook and just write out a couple pages of setting and a couple pages of rules and sit down and try playing it in a one-shotter with your friends, that there are suddenly so many things you think about you
and
didn't
before. And don't take
before.
The cheap way out of doing all percentile system on everything. Everybody does that on their first one.
Well, or they just radically rip off any existing system. Yeah. It's basically a D20 thing or whatever. But you know, really try doing it from the ground up and look at the math. Sitting down to play it, and suddenly you have to realize things like, well, the rules don't really account for this. So either we can write in a note to hand wave it, which is open to interpretation and possibly abusable, or we can try and define everything, and pretty soon you have the Champions rule book, which they're shipping overseas for use as body armor in the Middle East. There's a lot of things that I think come out about gaming that you don't see until you attempt that side of it. You know, it's real easy to shoot at what everyone else is doing, and maybe accurately so. In the case of Champions, maybe literally so, but it's...
Did you just make three RPG shooting puns in one sentence?
Not puns so much as left-handed suggestions of
shooting champions. Okay, I'm down with that.
So, Chad, let's go back to what you were talking about midway through that topic.
I don't remember.
I do. And this is something that I'd love to develop here, because this is something our group is sort of toying with. It's not our main game. Our main game is a D&D 3.5 game, mm-hmm. which has some aspects of collaboration.
Yes.
But you...
In the world creation aspect.
Yeah. Right. We've talked about this in previous episodes where each of us was given a different slice of the setting that was some part of our character's background, which we developed. And as we developed, it became canon for everyone, for mm-hmm. the GM, for the other players. It's just, this is the way it goes. And we each had a hand in building the world. And we've talked about the virtues of that, of how it gives us a greater sense of control and ownership and emotional investment, guarantees there's at least one corner of the world that was cooked to our taste. Mm-hmm. It also creates some interesting dynamics for the GM and players, because they have to figure out how to make all these different dynamics gel into one coherent, mm-hmm. cogent universe. But then we go over to something like Dread, mm-hmm. which you have taken a lot of concepts from to work into your lucid dream game, as you're mm-hmm. calling it, your modification of Inception, which one of the things that you have in there, for example, is that each of the characters is given a series of leading questions to mm-hmm. answer.
And that's taken from Dread.
Yeah, it was just taken from Dread. And for example, you have for one of the characters, why do you feel sympathy for the Mark?
Right.
And with this, you are not just giving the person the ability to build their character. Mm-hmm. Not even just as we have with our D&D game building the setting, but in a sense, this person is now writing the plot.
That's right.
Because when our group played this Inception game on a Sunday meetup, and we had mm-hmm. Mikey Mason, he was in town, he came out and hung with us, I ended up getting that question of why do you have sympathy for
the Mark? I had some aspect of a question, because the whole concept of Inception is that there's a mark, there's a target, you enter their dreams and you steal a piece of information from them using psychological sort of dream
and
tricks.
We won't spoil anything for anyone who hasn't seen the movie, so no need to fast forward.
Yep. And in the questionnaires, I think I put a question, at least one, maybe more questions about the mark for each person to answer. And they were specific questions, but they were open-ended and they were out of context. So to answer the question, you had to become specific and put them into context. When I came to the game to run it, I had nothing. And this goes beyond just, oh, I'm an improv GM. I mean, that certainly helped, but I had nothing written at all. I had no plot. I had no story. I had nothing when I sat down at that table. I didn't even have anything 20 or 30 minutes into the game, because they had to fill out all the questionnaires. And when I got to the questionnaires, I read them and I learned about their characters, because there were also questions about their individual characters that they were playing, still open-ended, unspecific questions that you answer and you put them in context and all that sort of stuff. And they learned about their characters. They painted a situation for me, because there is cross tension that I built into the questionnaires that makes one character have tension and drama with another character, that makes a third character have tension and drama that's separate from that. And you build all that in, this sort of framework establishes, but the mark is undefined and they create the mark. They don't even necessarily know it. Or if they do, they only create one small part of it. And I put it all together.
And the mark is, of course, really the fulcrum of the plot.
Yes.
And therefore, in writing these characters, Well, historically, what I've done in my most successful campaigns is I have an overarching plot in mind. And I've described this in previous episodes as I write the what's really going on document, which defines these massive world events or whatever the plot is about. And when people give me their character backgrounds, I will take elements from the character backgrounds and say, okay, this major character in the overarching plot is now this guy's long lost brother. I'll personalize it, or I'll find some way to say, hey, you know, this guy's got a background with some conspiracy group. And so I'm going to weave that into what I'm doing. And I draw the characters into it. But the basic flow of the plot, at least in some vague non-railroaded sense, was set somewhere back up the line. But in this case, you come to the game, and I remember the way I answered that question is, why do you have sympathy for the Mark? And I wrote down, because I don't know that I feel comfortable doing this to a child.
Yeah.
And handed it over to you, and now all of a sudden, I have just dictated this plot has to center around a child.
And then somebody else's answered a question. I don't remember what the question was, but the answer to the question put in context that he had slept with the Mark's wife. So now you have an 8-year-old child with a wife. And I took that as a challenge to make that work. And it was really interesting because in the first game of this I ran at Gen Con, it was totally different people, but the exact same questions. The Mark was a middle-aged Japanese-American computer programmer with not mother issues, but he was raised by an aunt and he had an overbearing aunt. And they kind of played that aspect of it. In the game that I ran on Sunday with these guys, the Mark was an 8-year-old Saudi boy who had a prearranged marriage with a 26-year-old Saudi woman, and he was the heir to an oil conglomerate.
I'm curious, though, about how you would go a step beyond that to collaborative rules building. Because rules, whether they are super thick and deep or something really highly abstracted like Amber Dysel's or Dread, you still have a basic structure that dictates, quite frankly, everything beginning with character creation. It seems like, unlike a plot, it's not the sort of thing you can build on the fly. Maybe during the design phase you could collaborate.
Here's what I would do. It wouldn't be something like Dread where I'd hand out a questionnaire and then in 10 minutes you guys have it filled out and handed back. This would be something that would take a couple of sessions to do. It'd take a couple of nights, probably 2 or 3 nights, I'd see. So the first thing I would do is we would pick out the genre and build the world. Wouldn't even touch mechanics. Not touch it with a 10-foot pole. What kind of game do you guys want story-wise? What do we want? Do we want this to be a swashbuckling adventure game? Do we want it to be gritty realistic? Do we want sci-fi? Do we want this? Okay, we got that. Let's build the world. And we're building the world. And even out of that, we build the characters. So we have all of this soft, fuzzy stuff first. And then when we have all that, we say, what kind of rules can we make that will fit this concept, this world, this what I consider the real part of the game, this world and story and characters? What mechanics can we make to support that and plug into this seamlessly? And people would say, well, we need high crunch tactics, minis, that sort of thing. Okay, that works. Or we need something that's, well, just for sake of example, the other end of the spectrum, we need diceless and concept driven and all this sort of stuff. And when there's a sort of consensus on what everyone wants, then we work from there. We take the long concepts and we start narrowing. It's like, okay, we're going to go for crunch. We want minis. What do we like out of minis? Do we want hexes? Do we want this? Well, I like this out of this game. I like this out of this game. Well, I don't like that, but I got this other idea. And there's, it's basically from step one of creating what kind of game we want all the way down to when we're ready to play. It is a giant brainstorming session that you have brainstormed everything. And was something that Wayne pointed out when we were talking about this topic before the mics is, do you even need a GM for that? Do you don't need a GM because, you know, somebody in the process of creating it, somebody might say, you know what, Dan's really good at sci-fi, Pat's really good at fantasy, and this is actually tending towards a fantasy game, and Dan was going to run it, and Dan's like, no, Pat, you should run the fantasy aspect because that's your thing.
Yeah, or as you're going through it, someone comes up, this world we've created, I have a story for it, I want to tell
right.
it. Or this world we've created, I was going to run this game, I want to play in it now.
So just to clarify the language a little bit, it's not that you don't have a GM, it's that you don't have a GM at the outset.
At the outset, but
the GM will need someone to play traffic cop.
Right.
But that doesn't have to be the person that's going to run the game.
That was my counter to Wayne's comment. Again, this whole conversation, we had the mics turned off. I think that's a great idea, but you need to designate one person to kind of be the leader, or if your group doesn't like to use words like leadership and stuff.
The best mediator.
Yeah, it's a mediator. It's somebody to say, okay, we're focusing a little too much on initiative. We have a good initiative system. We're going to run with this. Now let's focus on other areas. We have to keep the dialogue moving. Nobody has any ideas. Point to Dan. Dan, give me an idea on this aspect. Are there dragons in this world? No. Everybody cool with no dragons? Okay. Somebody to keep the dialogue going and to keep the brainstorming moving.
I would worry about something like this becoming too much of a mishmash, though. I mean, everything's thrown together to the point that it may not flow.
Well, and see, that's why you need this traffic cop. And that's why the GM is kind of a good candidate for this. You need a GM to keep things tight, to say, so Dan says, I want magic. And Pat says, I want sci-fi. And Wayne says, I want cyberpunk. And I say, well, I want giant mecha from anime. So then you start getting the riffs thing. Again, not a bash against riffs, but riffs is a little bit of everything. And it's got something for everyone, but it's all just a one big world.
You got your steampunk and my sci-fi.
Yeah, I actually agree with you, Wayne, on the fact that I think that it's a little too convoluted the way you're talking about it. I don't think this is something that you're going to do quickly. I don't think you're going to do it in two or three sessions like you'd suggested earlier.
I think
if you do this, I mean, if this level of detail that you're talking about, it's going to take a lot longer to do that, to sit down and really to put it in a cogent form that makes sense and not have it just completely.
We did our current game. We created an entire world for
We're playing it in 3.5. That's a point I wanted to make earlier too. This whole thing about a homebrew, I think there are two aspects of a homebrew. There's the homebrew where you've come up with your own world and you've defined the world that you want to play in. That in itself, to me, is a valid homebrew.
There is also
the homebrew of, I want a new mechanic that can be applied to whatever. Then there's the third, which is the combination of the two. And you guys just immediately jump to the combination of the two. I think that there's also the one or the other. You're talking about both.
Yeah.
So when you're doing both, I think that defining the world may be easier. But if you're going to sit down and come up with a mechanic that actually works, I don't think you can do it in two or three sessions.
Well, I think you can.
I disagree.
I completely disagree.
With your point that there are certainly degrees of homebrewing. And that is worth mentioning, that you can take an existent system and homebrew a setting for it, and vice versa. Yeah. You can take an existent setting and homebrew a system for it, or you can do both. I think the only reason we jump to both is not because of a presupposition that one of the other possibilities simply isn't there or isn't worth talking about, but rather because I think that's how the conversation was framed that led up to this particular episode. It was a conversation about why is it we have such a habit of homebrewing, and the implicit examples in there were things where we had homebrewed the entirety of the game. Mm-hmm. While, once again, we may have drawn inspiration from other places, system, setting, all of it was more or less designed from the ground up. Now, let me suggest an alternate way of approaching this collaboration technique, whether you are using it for system, setting, the group template, the plot, whatever you're collaborating on, something that might be better than a traffic cop. And this comes from some training that I was forced to go through back when I was working for a home builder, and I did get some value out of it, but I got taught all the Dr. Duran industrial techniques. And one of the techniques in there is they have a whole thing on group problem solving. And the way that they suggested doing it, and I'm going to abbreviate this because it's a really long and involved thing, but the first step is you have a brainstorming session. And in the brainstorming session, there are two rules. Rule number one is every idea is accepted. Rule number two is no idea is debated. If somebody says something, whether it's a piece of paper or a whiteboard or a chalkboard, you write it down. It all goes up there. And the reason they do that is because if you get caught up trying to debate a particular idea, number one, the conversation stops flowing. Number two, people start getting focused on the trees instead of the forest. And number three, other people may become more reticent to throw out their own ideas because they don't want to be subjected to scrutiny. So what you do is you simply write down everything. You just take a mental number two, write it all down. Once it's all up there, then you elect somebody or a group of people to basically start going through the ideas, picking out patterns, picking out things that seem to match, figuring out where stuff lines up. And you see this sort of emergent design come out of the whole thing. And now at this point, if you have to, you might do some high level debating of certain issues. Okay, what's everyone's gotta has versus will not accepts? Cross those off the list or highlight those. And then you kind of drill down from that to, okay, this was not on anybody's can't have or must have list, but these two ideas contradict. Why do we like one idea or the other? And you debate it out. But you start with this whole free flow thing and you just narrow it down as slowly as you can to basically keep the entire idea as broad and free flowing as possible. And I think that's something I would definitely want to apply to this kind of process. And we did apply it. In our current D&D game, there was nothing that, at least in my case, I sent into you, Chad, to which you said no. Mm-hmm. When we talk about this Inception game that we had on Sunday, it was the same thing. You took these ideas that were completely brainstormed in a vacuum, could have just as easily been done together on a whiteboard, and you went with all of them. You found a way to see an emergent story that all of these ideas together paint.
Dan, do you think that being able to see those, all those separate ideas and being able to bring them together, do you think that's a learned skill? Do you think that's something we can give some advice on? Or do you think that, somebody either has it or they don't?
You know, and we actually were talking about this the other day. Could someone like you, Dan, who's, you plan ahead quite a bit, you come into a game very well prepared, could you run this kind of system where you have no clue your setting, your characters, your story, nothing when you sit down?
I'm going to go with a both and. Could I? Yes. Could I do it as well as, for example, Chad does? No, because I'm just wired differently. Mm. I think there is truth in both of the old adages that poets are born, not made, and practice makes perfect. I think both are true in different ways. I would say if you're doing this collaborative thing, I think absolutely yes, there is some amount of it. You just kind of have to be wired for it. But I would hope that in any gaming group, especially if you've got 3, 4, 5, 6 people, there's got to be somebody in there who can at least get close enough to make it work. But beyond that, I think it is true that even someone who's not quite perfect at it, with a little bit of training, could do it. For example, I think one of the things I would bring to the table really well, at least in the brainstorming phase, is that I'm a good mediator. I'm good at finding the middle ground. And that's not per se because I'm always trying to sell out to both sides. It's oftentimes because my view really is fairly nuanced and in the middle. And that's something that's just how I am. Now, I think someone who's not wired that way could make the very conscious choice to say, okay, I'm going to chill out. I'm going to back off on my own opinions. And I'm just going
to... It's rare for me to do that.
It's rare. Well, you know, and you're not alone in that. There's a lot of people I've known who just cannot put their own opinions aside. But I put cannot in imagined quotes,
right?
Because everybody can. It's a conscious choice. You just say, I'm not going to do this. Yeah.
And that's not a bad thing. And I say this in my own defense, is if you're brainstorming something and you feel passionate about it, that's a good thing.
Right. And I think conversely, Chad, you are better than I am at, for example, seeing these emergent patterns and dealing with them on the fly. Mm-hmm. Now, are there things I could learn to become better at that? And I think the answer is absolutely yes. One of which would be to not overthink things, to free flow with ideas. If an idea comes out, to just say it and keep going. There's a writing exercise you can do along these lines where you write a stream of consciousness fiction. You sit down with no outline. Pat's making faces. I didn't say publish it.
Stream of consciousness.
I didn't say publish it.
The worst form of writing ever invented.
Do you hate writing it or do you hate reading it or both?
I hate reading it. Well, I would never write it.
Okay, well, hold on.
Because it's an abomination.
Let me first of all clarify. There is an actual genre of stream of consciousness where you literally just have written out somebody's thoughts as they flow, their experiences as they occur. That's not what I'm referring to. What I mean by stream of consciousness is more an unfettered stream of ideas that you get from somewhere, a random topic, a random subject matter, and without an outline, without any kind of notes, without any editing, no backspacing or deleting unless you're fixing a typo, no pausing, you start writing and create a story, no matter how bad it is, until you've reached a certain point, 1,000 words or whatever it is you're writing to.
And I love doing this as a beginning method. I'll do something like that. I'll sit down. I'll do the whole stream of consciousness. I'll read everything. I'll take it all in. And then I'll close the document, delete the document.
It's a writing exercise.
And rewrite that whole thing.
Exactly.
Planned out.
It's a writing exercise. I'm not suggesting this to go write the next great novel. but it's a writing exercise. And what it teaches you to do is to unpucker. teaches you to accept.
That is probably the best analogy I think I've ever heard for it. It's just so disgusting.
That's some of this stuff is not going to be perfect, but as Voltaire said, the perfect is the enemy of the good. And Chad, for example, is that a skill that I could learn? Is to accept less control, less preparation, to learn through practice.
I think
how to roll with my mistakes, to learn through psychological training, to accept my mistakes.
For you, in my observation of you, I think to run a game like Dread or to run a free-form collaborative game with no preparation, the biggest thing for you personally is to release control. Because you really, and that's not a bad thing. Control means having notes, having a plan, having a map laid out to where you know where you're going and you know how to get there. That's not a criticism. That's a very good thing. That is one of my greatest weaknesses as a game master. But running the type of game that I run, or the more free flow, hippie, story stick, right, whatever you want to call it game, it is a matter of allowing control, allowing players to open up for abuse or for to do whatever they want. And the thing is, you have to remember that in these games, it's not about abuse. It's about everyone coming together.
It's about trust.
Story. It's about trust, exactly.
Yeah. And my style with the notes heavy allows for complexity and consistency.
Yes.
But your style allows for collaboration. Mm-hmm. Now, I may be able to do, as I mentioned earlier, integration, mm-hmm, but that's different than collaboration.
Yeah, and Dan, I think really the bigger issue here, too, is like what you're saying is, could you learn to do that? Yes, certainly, I think you could.
Would you enjoy
but
it?
Do you really want to? Right. That's right. The bigger question. That's a bigger question for everybody is, yeah, you could probably learn how to do it and maybe get to where you're good at it. But should you do you really want to? That's what you have to answer. Do you want to do this?
And I
if
could
so,
take,
great. If not, if you don't think that's something you really want to do.
Yeah.
You know,
I agree
stick
with Pat.
What, you know, do what you're good at.
I agree with Pat because I could run a game where I write as many notes or I do as much preparation as Dan does. I would not enjoy it. I don't like taking that many notes. But alternatively, in doing the show, in discussing our styles and in growing an awareness of my own style instead of just doing it, but actually having to talk about it and then having to defend it and listening to your styles, listening to everybody's style, I do take more notes now. I have more, where I come to a table and have none. Now I have some. They might be bullet points, little reminders, little words that are a feeling that kind of send me down a road.
Character names, because we've told you it kills our immersion.
You know, Chad,
I do write down.
You know, the point I think that you're making there, and this is one that I think is a good point for everybody, is what you're doing is you're taking minor aspects of things and that you didn't do before, and you've incorporated those into what you're doing. It's not that you're changing what you do wholesale. Yeah. What
growth
you're doing is
not selling out.
You've modified a little bit. You've taken a little bit from here and there. So like Dan, on the flip side of it, you probably wouldn't enjoy doing the stream. You probably wouldn't enjoy doing the collaborative wholesale like Chad does, but you can take an aspect or two and add that to your style. And there you go. Like you said, you've grown. It's a little bit of a new game.
Well,
and so that's, I think, what people should shoot for is, I'm not saying don't try new things like for a few minutes ago, but try things that maybe you're not comfortable with or you don't really like a little bit. Maybe you'll get something out of it. You'll glean a nugget of something good for your own game. Yeah.
You know, and that's one of the good things about our group that I think a lot of groups have as well. We have different people with very different ideas that run games very differently. I enjoy every way they're run. Mm-hmm.
I love a Dan game.
I love a Chad game. Mm-hmm. And I love them for different reasons. And because they're both running them together, they're getting things from each other. I think every group has something like that. And if everyone takes a chance to actually run games, you'll see that.
The only game I didn't enjoy was a Pat game. And that was because Pat didn't enjoy a Pat game. Because you don't like running games.
Yeah.
Pat, to your question, would I enjoy it? I don't know that it's something that I would enjoy doing indefinitely. And the only way you win at role-playing games is having fun. Mm-hmm. You should not force yourself into some kind of a paradigm that someone else is using simply because it sounds cool or somehow seems intimidatingly better, whatever exactly that means, that you should absolutely use the style that you're most comfortable with.
Yeah, for example, I shouldn't run Heroes game. I might as well drop it on my foot because I'm going to have just as much fun screaming in pain as I would trying to understand the rule system.
But here's the question, and this is not a rhetorical question. This is an honest question that I think everyone has to answer internally. So it's for you guys as much as the listeners at home. which is, are you willing to work for your hobby? Here's an example that was given to me by an English teacher I had back in high school who, quite frankly, was a bit of a bitch, but it was a...
English teachers say her name always and edit are. It out.
Just to put it in perspective, this is a lady who once gave somebody a negative grade. They literally would have gotten a better grade on the paper. They would have gotten a zero, having slept and done nothing. The paper she turned in, she gave them a negative 50% on. But anyway, it's a completely different topic for a completely different time.
I would bitch slap her something fierce.
But here's the question she raised. We were going through these writing exercises and everyone's like, these are stupid. What's the point? And she said, have you ever seen a football game where the football players in the middle of the game threw down a bunch of tires and started running through them? And the obvious answer is no, that you do these exercises to build skills that are applicable to the game, even though they are not themselves apparent in the game. And in the same way, and this is not a rhetorical question, because some people are going to say, look, it's a hobby. I don't take it that seriously. If I have to work at this, this has missed the point of what my free time is about. But for people who are kind of interested in seeing how they can expand, whether they can take it to the next level, once again, whatever exactly that means, trying other styles, trying these weird collaborations, trying these one-shotters and high-concept games, you can do things to stretch your skill, to stretch your own mind, to get you thinking in new directions. And is that how I would run all of my games thereafter? Probably not. But would I learn a valuable lesson that I might be able to apply to some aspect of my future well-structured, note-heavy, non-collaborative games? Probably so. Mm-hmm. And so for that reason, would I enjoy it in the long run? Probably not. Would I do it, though? I absolutely would.
I would absolutely love to play in a game that you ran that was completely diceless and ultra rules light, like Dread or Don't Rest Your Head or Lucid.
And I'm sure
like
I would learn a lot from doing it.
Mm-hmm. Maybe at Fear the Con.
I'm looking at Transformers and more Star Trek ship on ship because that seems to be the popular request from me.
I might indulge myself in this Fear the Con and be in your Transformers game because we haven't done that since we were kids.
Well,
it's awesome.
And I got that wrist set just for the little wooden cubes for Energon.
It was so, I saw that you had bought Risk and I'm like, the hell is he buying that for?
And it was the wooden cubes.
And it was hanging around, and then at the game you busted it out. I'm not even at this game. I'm walking by and somebody's talking about Transformers. I see it and I'm like, oh my god, that's genius.
But
I think I even ran over and totally interrupted your game just to tell you that.
If there is anything you guys want to see us or anybody else run at Fear the Con, or there's something you're thinking about running, there is a thread going for that in the forums. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that I'll link it off the show notes because
Return to a Black Man's Atlantis. I can't wait.
So anyway, I think we've pretty much come to where we need to on this one. So thank you guys for tuning in. Don't forget once again the Tracy Hickman thing. Check the show notes for all kinds of fun stuff we talked about in this show. And we will catch you next time.
See ya.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2010. Listeners are free to use the show in a non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.